Chapter 6, The Birth of Big Pharma and the Ghost of Reform. In May 1962, Vannevar Bush returned to Washington on a familiar mission to defend private patent power against the Democratic claims of a populist senator from the South. His new adversary was Estes Kefauver of Tennessee. Harley Kilgore's longtime protege on the Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly. Since inheriting the committee scepter upon Kilgore's death in 1956, Kefauver had proven himself a worthy successor, both in his dedication to the anti-monopoly cause and in his ability to draw forth the pipe-puffing disdain of corporate executives and patrician elites in the Vannevar Bush mold. A Chattanooga lawyer, born on a family farm in rural East Tennessee, Kefauver entered Congress in 1939 as a New Deal loyalist and the most liberal member of his state's delegation. A decade later, he beat a Memphis party boss in an upstart Senate run that drew attention for the candidate's signature coonskin campaigning cap. Like Kilgore, his speech was simple and direct, and his hatred of monopoly pure. He forged his national profile with a successful effort to weld shut loopholes in the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914 that allowed companies to raid the assets of weaker competitors under the guise of horizontal mergers. His follow-up crusade, a two-year traveling investigation into organized crime, made him one of the first political celebrities of the television age. His closest allies in preserving the anti-monopoly politics of the New Deal were Wright Patman in the House and his Senate colleague Russell B. Long, son of the populist governor and senator Huey Kingfish Long. Bush appeared before Kefauver's committee to offer testimony in an investigation the senator launched in 1959 into the drug industry's patent and pricing practices. The former OSRD director was now 72, and no longer active in Washington power circles, but his celebrity had taken on the weight of legend. This had less to do with his role in the war than it did his new reputation as a prophet scientist whose inventions anticipated the jet age and chimed retroactively with the optimistic futurism of the Kennedy administration's new frontier mythos. Our transition from an economy of scarcity to an economy of plenty is directly traceable to the prescience of Vannevar Bush, declared the author of The Scientific Age, a popular science book of the era. Bush did not appear before Kefauver's committee in this capacity. He was doing his duty in the final months of his term as chairman of the board at Merck & Company, a position he'd held since 1957. He was there to put the force of his name behind the drug industry's organized opposition to the patent reform bill. That bill, Senate Bill 1552, was aimed at the heart of an industry that had completed a metamorphosis from the ethical business of the 19th century into the rapacious and monopolistic one of the 20th. This new industry would have been unrecognizable to old gatekeepers. Spending on misleading and crass marketing, once as controversial as patents, had overtaken many firms' research budgets. Fleets of salespeople known as detail men haunted waiting rooms to sell physicians on the advantages of expensive trademarked products over generics. The taboo against medical monopolies had turned into a race to collect and defend, by hook or by crook, the 17-year patents that had become the coin of the pharmaceutical realm. The huge markups these patents enabled made U.S. drug prices the highest in the world, producing corporate profit margins unique to the post-war economy, double and often triple those found in other manufacturing sectors. Kefauver opened the committee's first hearing in 1959 with an Upjohn-patented anti-inflammatory steroid sold at a markup of 1,118% over the cost of production. In the subsequent 2 years leading up to Bush's appearance, Kefauver had sparred with a rogues gallery of drug company CEOs over much larger markups of 2,000 to 3,000%. Within these numbers was the story of an industry that had shed its former identity as a self-consciously ethical actor and become a caricature of socially destructive greed. The drug industry began the post-war era riding high. Wartime research had accelerated a so-called therapeutic revolution that produced a steady march of breakthrough medicines with wide application, spanning antibiotics, steroids, and anti-diabetics. U.S. drug firms introduced, on average, 50 new products every year during the 1950s, twice the rate of the previous decade. But these blockbuster drugs were marketed under a profusion of pricey trademarks through advertising campaigns designed to push pills in ways once associated with patent medicines of the previous century. The result was a very profitable state of public and medical confusion, leading to systematic overprescribing and misuse. People died. One case that later came to light involved the innovator of ethical patenting, Parke Davis. After the company was granted the monopoly on the antibiotic chloramphenicol in 1949, the Detroit drug maker marketed it as a cure for common conditions it had no known activity against. Its marketing efforts persisted after the drug was linked to hundreds of cases of aplastic anemia, a fatal blood disease. As in the case of aspirin at the start of the century, Americans knew they were being gouged. By 1953, more than 60% of Americans thought drug prices were too high. That year, the Federal Trade Commission authorized an investigation into cartel behavior and price fixing in the booming antibiotics market. After languishing for 2 years, the probe finally got underway in 1955, the first ever government probe of the industry not related to the safety and purity of its products. Harley Kilgore, who died a year into the FTC probe, would have relished the showdown with Bush over the post-war drug industry. The West Virginia New Dealer had, after all, predicted the patent abuses that were beginning to come to light. The industry's explosive growth during the 1950s was based largely on monopoly profits derived from inventions that benefited from government research and tech transfer programs. Even the industry's in-house research capabilities were built on a foundation of wartime contracts and subsidized tech transfer. Under the New Deal plan championed by Kilgore, many of these monopolies, and the outsized economic and political power they conferred, would not have been possible. Gefauver understood this, but had taken an indirect route to his confrontation with Bush. After inheriting Kilgore's chairmanship of the Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly in 1957, he announced major investigations into price-fixing and anti-competitive behavior in a number of industries suffering what Brandeis called the curse of bigness. Big auto, big steel, even big bread came in for the Gefauver treatment. In his statements and introductory remarks, Gefauver delivered Brandeisian denunciations of industrial collusion and economic giantism as mutations of capitalism that threaten the nation's experiment in self-government. "It is only a step from the loss of economic freedom to the loss of political freedom," Gefauver warned at the start of his hearings. A third great merger movement was underway, powered by the competitive avarice of certain giant corporate enterprises. Cold War politics had complicated Gefauver's ability to replicate Thurman Arnold's approach to manhandling American executives, but he was steadfast in his belief that it was they, not the anti-monopolists, who raised the specter of statism followed by the seizure of economic and industrial power. Though the business press cast him as a would-be Southern-fried Soviet commissar, seeking to institute complete Gefauver controls, in all K's, in the words of a 1960 article in Sales Management magazine, he never flinched. During his 5 years of investigative hearings, he dragged dozens of the country's most powerful executives through tough interrogations that began with the assumption they were the enemies of democracy and free enterprise. Gefauver had guts. He faced down mob bosses Frank Costello and Mickey Cohen in his organized crime hearings, and in 1960 risked his re-election in a southern state by supporting desegregation and civil rights. The idea of extending the big hearings to drug companies belonged to Irene Till, an FTC staff economist who was married to Walton Hamilton, the Yale law professor who authored the 1941 Teaneck Report on Patents and Free Enterprise. Gefauver was excited by the idea, had been thinking along similar lines, and hired Till to help prepare and oversee the drug industry investigation. She brought with her another FTC economist, John Blair, who had led the commission's mid-1950s investigation into the antibiotics market that dredged up evidence of rampant patent fraud, patent abuse, and price fixing. The FTC investigation did not help the industry's image, but its findings rarely landed on the front page, and it failed to change any laws. The companies were just starting to relax, believing the matter behind them, when the letters arrived from Gefauver's office requesting their appearance on Capitol Hill. In December 1959, Big Pharma became the last industry to take its turn under the bright lights of the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly. "We've led a sheltered life for years," an anonymous drug company official told the New York Times, "but we're really in for a bad time now." The FTC's 1955 probe into the antibiotics market ended the drug company's long run of avoiding federal attention to their patent and prices practices. Not many research-based industries had been so lucky. The year before, Dwight Eisenhower's Justice Department came to terms on a historic consent decree with AT&T ending a suit initiated by Harry Truman in 1949 related to patent hoarding and anti-competitive behavior by AT&T's research company, Bell Labs. The company's intellectual property vault formed the basis of the Bell System phone monopoly controlled by AT&T and Western Electric. It had also come to form a massive bottleneck to multiple emergent fields of research. By forcing Bell Labs to issue hundreds of licenses on early solid-state transistor and laser technology, the consent decree effectively seeded the nation's computer and high-technology industries. Eisenhower was nobody's idea of a crusading agrarian populist, but his antitrust and patent policies shared more in common with the late New Deal than the Republican Melanist administrations of the 1920s. During his 2 terms, Eisenhower's Justice Department enforced more than 100 judgments against American companies, resulting in the compulsory licensing of some 40,000 patents. In his final State of the Union, Eisenhower expressed what sounded like genuine pride in this record. The drug companies began the 1950s with ambitious goals and a plan to achieve them. Uniting them was a shared desire to enlarge the legal scope for claims on what the U.S. Patent Code called products of nature. This had always been a murky legal area for medical patent claims. The companies understood that the next stage of the therapeutic revolution involved new antibiotics and other medicines based on microbial cultures and processes found in soils, molds, and fungi. But in order to lock in long-term monopoly profits, the patents needed to be accessible and, once claimed, bulletproof. Before 1952, the language of the U.S. Patent Code and court precedent left ample room for rejecting claims on drugs deemed to be products of nature or that insufficiently reflected a flash of creative genius. There was very little creativity in what the drug companies were doing, and the products themselves were basically gifts of nature, writes the historian Graham Dutfield. What they sought was blanket patent coverage. The leading drug companies hired the New York State Bar Association to draft a bill to change the problematic language. In consultation with the industry's patent lawyers, the NYSBA wrote a bill that replaced the creative genius threshold with one lower to the ground, non-obviousness. The legislation also stretched the definition of novel compositions of matter, patentable, to encompass a greater share of claims likely to be rejected as products of nature, unpatentable. Whatever the companies paid the New York Bar and its lobbyists, it was money well spent. The industry's Republican allies pushed the bill through Congress, and Truman signed it toward the end of his term to little fanfare or criticism. The 1952 law was a milestone in the industry's self-awareness and confidence as a political agent. It was also a demonstration of something other industries had known for a century. In patent policy, offense is better than defense. By the end of the 1950s, the biggest companies were selling well over 100 antibiotics under 500 trademarks in a $330 million market. Name brand molds and bacteria brought the capitalization of U.S. firms within passing distance of the mighty Germans. The companies failed to achieve so clear a victory against the ever-present risk of a return to patent populism, however. The locus of industry concern was a cabinet-level agency created in April 1953 called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, or HEW. Even after the Republican victory in shaping the National Science Foundation and post-war science policy generally, agency chiefs still had the option of retaining title on government-funded inventions. The stakes of this choice were enormous when it came to HEW. Its position on the federal science flowchart gave its secretary power to decide the dispensation of rights on medical research conducted in a fast-growing network of hundreds, soon to be thousands, of labs funded by the National Institutes of Health. In 1955, the agency's first secretary, Ovita Culp Hobby, realized the sum of all industry fears by announcing a patent policy that retained exclusive rights on all NIH-funded research and invention for the government. HEW would pursue a generous licensing policy with low royalties to encourage broad access and maximum diffusion of publicly financed science. The HEW bylaws also required prompt publication by NIH-sponsored researchers, a slap against the growing practice of monopoly-minded drug companies pressuring university partners to maximize competitive market advantage. The HEW policy was not ironclad. in rare cases where exclusive rights were deemed critical to the commercial development of an important medicine, HEW empowered the Surgeon General to make special deals, known as Institutional Patent Agreements, or IPAs. The exclusive licenses allowed under the IPA program were conditional on the contractor making the invention available to the public on reasonable terms. By 21st century standards, the money involved when Hobby announced the policy was small, but it was, like everything else in the post-war economy, growing by the day. Between 1947 and 1957, the NIH budget ballooned from $8 million to $183 million. Some of this money funded inventions whose titles ended up in industry hands through the IPA program. In the first 5 years of HEW's existence, two surgeon generals granted 18 IPAs to universities and private companies. The HEW policy was not the only patent fire that required tending in the mid-1950s. The monopolies on many of the blockbuster drugs developed in the early 1940s were set to expire at the end of the decade. Between 1864 and 1994, U.S. patents lasted 17 years. How that number was extended and continues to grow is a subject explored in subsequent chapters. If companies were to avoid this looming patent cliff and maintain their stratospheric post-war growth, they would have to find new patented blockbusters, either through in-house R&D or the IPA exception, and defend the scope and duration of their patents. One thing the pharmaceutical industry did not need at decade's end was public scrutiny. The opening of the Kefauver hearings in 1959 was, like all of Kefauver investigations, a media event. The press would get its first sustained look at the guts of the post-ethical drug industry. The most dramatic findings would land in the papers, if not beamed directly into millions of American living rooms. For more than 2 years, Kefauver and his staff lifted the hood on industry claims that monopoly prices were the necessary cost of innovation and progress, a cost that did not reflect greed, but the expense of engaging in complex and socially vital R&D. Often featuring former industry insiders and whistleblowers, the hearings revealed an industry spending 3 times more on marketing than on research. The thrust of this research did not match the picture presented by squirming executives. Much of it focused on tweaking old drugs to make new ones that were redundant in everything but the new patent number. The industry's biggest recent breakthroughs were habit-forming drugs of dubious benefit to public health, amphetamines, and a new class of sedative marketed as tranquilizers. To Kefauver and many Democrats, all this amounted to a strong case for closer regulation, especially of the $2.5 billion prescription drug market. By the end of 1961, after 2 years of continuous hearings, Kefauver began drafting a bill touching on every aspect of the industry, from patents to advertising and safety. The Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association and its affiliated advertising club responded with a campaign attacking Kefauver's subcommittee as a kangaroo court that threatened medical progress and American freedoms. A November 1961 editorial cartoon in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch depicted a hand-rubbing pharmaceutical executive huddled around a lab beaker with a gaggle of company scientists. "We've got it," the executive exclaims. "A tranquilizer for Kefauver." When Bush finally appeared before Kefauver's committee, the investigation was winding down. The resulting bill, Senate Bill 1552, proposed a slate of deep reforms to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act based on nearly 11,000 pages of testimony. If passed, it would cut the term of drug patents from 17 years to 3, require drug companies to license their drugs to all qualified domestic and foreign competitors with royalties capped at 8%, and ensure patents were reserved for genuinely novel inventions, by establishing a higher legal standard of meaningful molecular difference. The bill contained rules to encourage the prescribing of generics, added teeth to FDA oversight of drug testing and approval, and set limits on pharmaceutical advertising that harkened back to the now antiquated AMA Code of Ethics. Kefauver knew his bill faced an uphill battle despite strong Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. Many of the staunchest old New Dealers were gone. Their replacements were made of softer stuff, and cautious about being seen as too hard on a system the industry's public relations firms spent heavily promoting as the free market and the American way. The Kennedy administration had its hands full with crises in Berlin and Mississippi and sent word that the president could not be counted on to support Kefauver's attempt to restructure the pharmaceutical industry. Bush knew about Kefauver's weak political hand on the spring morning in 1962 when he took his seat in the marble-walled Senate chamber beside John T. Connor, the wartime general counsel of the OSRD, now working as the president of Merck. Connor was no stranger to the chamber. He'd been trading barbs with Kefauver in person and in the press since the start of the hearings, which he'd recently declared a masterpiece in the art of propaganda, but the reverse of what thoughtful citizens expect in a democracy. Bush had no history with Kefauver and had not publicly commented on the hearings before his appearance. Bush opened his remarks with a joke about the lighting in the chamber, suggesting the Senate find a new electrical engineer. Kefauver frostily informed Bush the lighting arrangement was requested by the camera crew in the back of the room, which was filming the proceedings on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association. Bush then turned to his prepared statement. To fully appreciate the malign impact of the reforms being proposed, Bush told the committee it was necessary to recall the miseries and horrors of pre-modern medicine. If future generations were to see the medicines of 1962 as equally primitive, it was essential to protect the integrity of the 17-year drug patent. "You gentlemen have a blunt instrument in your hands," said Bush. "If you use it, you will do great harm to a complex organism. We are embarked on a great adventure to make life more healthy and sane. Our progress must not be slowed down now." To heighten the emotional impact of this point, Bush evoked an even more gruesome nightmare than conscious surgery, the thermal wounds endured by the theoretical survivors of a Third World War. Leaving aside its relevance for the patent issue, Bush was likely sincere in his preoccupation with the horrors of nuclear war. As director of OSRD, he advocated for the collective management of nuclear knowledge by the major powers and international agencies. He also opposed the decisions to test the H-bomb and develop hypersonic missiles. "A nuclear war would be far more terrible than any war in history," said Bush, who oversaw the programs that developed napalm and the atom bomb. "In addition to hydrogen bombs with their burns and radiation, we might also meet a still more appalling weapon in the hands of men with no conscience. Biological warfare. This is no time to weaken our medical system or the pharmaceutical industry which supports it. Compulsory licenses for all comers are bound to prevent the very kind of healthy competition in discovering new products that now characterize the industry." There is no record of Kefauver's reaction to Bush's use of atomic anxiety as an emotional cudgel wielded in the defense of drug patents, but the senator may very well have rolled his eyes at Bush's lack of imagination. The Soviet threat and nuclear war had been recurring tropes in the testimony of drug executives throughout 2 years of hearings, most of them lifted straight from the industry's updated Cold War playbook. In 1958, the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association hired the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton to develop a campaign that positioned patent-based drug companies as symbols of a free society and bulwarks in the fight against global communism at home and abroad. "Probably through no other industry can the superiority of our American competitive system be demonstrated so impressively," declared the PMA chairman in 1960. The message was repeated across thousands of booklets and magazine ads sponsored by the PMA, which asked readers to ponder the question, "Who's winning the human race?" The campaign painted the industry's critics as un-American and warned that reforming the patent monopoly system could only result in a Soviet-ruled dark age of primitive medicine, if not the irradiated hellscape invoked by Bush. When Bush finished his brief statement, Kefauver dismissed the familiar bait of a hypothetical Third World War. He preferred to talk about the Second. "There appeared to be a mismatch," noted the senator, "between the argument that only private drug monopolies can spur medical progress and the former OSRD director's wartime role in producing history-making generic penicillin." "Dr. Bush, I have here the Federal Trade Commission's report on antibiotic manufacturers of June 1958, which sets forth how you arrange for the licensing, manufacture, and sale of penicillin," said Kefauver, tapping the government tome. "Were you in favor of the patent title going to the companies and not to the government?" Grasping the trap Kefauver had set, Bush appeared uncharacteristically flustered, to the point of pretending not to understand the question. "I don't quite get the point," said Bush. "You are talking about the handling of penicillin during the war?" After some back and forth, Bush resigned himself to the senator's determination to talk about the wartime penicillin project. "Yes, during the war," said Bush, "the story there is a very interesting one indeed." In the spring of 1943, while Allied generals planned the initial thrust into Axis-occupied Europe, British soldiers were practicing a different sort of thrust. In the brothels of Algiers and Tunis, they contracted venereal disease by the thousand. The infected included many of the commandos and paratroopers scheduled to spearhead the imminent invasion of Sicily. Officers watched with alarm as elite troops fell sick from the same bacteria that had plagued Roman imperial legions when they occupied the same African cities. Neisseria gonorrhoeae. Howard Florey, the Oxford University pharmacologist and future Nobel Prize winner, was flown to Morocco and debriefed on the situation. He carried with him a small but precious amount of a gray mold called penicillium, discovered in 1928 by Alexander Fleming in an overloaded laboratory sink at London's St. Mary's Hospital. Florey was part of the three-man team at Oxford that isolated the active molecule and proved its clinical application. In 1941, he started working on an Anglo-American effort to produce penicillin at industrial scale. When he toured the African field hospitals, that puzzle remained unsolved, and he had to be stingy with the small batch supply. But even after proving its efficacy against gonorrhea, he needed the go-ahead from a priggish British officer corps that hesitated to sanction use of the mold to treat the self-inflicted wounds of venereal disease. The blushing indecision eventually reached up the chain of command to an exasperated Winston Churchill, who personally gave the order to use the penicillin immediately. To maximize supply, Florey recycled the urine of each patient. It proved just enough. The healed commandos opened the Second European Front on July 10, 1943. Meanwhile, the Anglo-American program to crack the code of penicillin's industrial production was making progress in the American Midwest. The effort dated to 1941, when Florey and his scientific partner, Ernst Chain, traveled to the United States and convinced officials that penicillin could be scaled up. They showed the Americans everything they knew about the miracle mold and shared their ideas about using fermentation to increase yields. 3 years later, the program spanned nearly 40 labs, employing 1,500 scientists. Its size was second only to the Manhattan Project. The breakthrough occurred at a Department of Agriculture laboratory in Peoria, Illinois, where government scientists had been working on deep fermentation technology since the 1930s. This work provided the base for a process resulting in a penicillin mold 80 times more potent than the small batches cultivated by the Oxford team. The effort was directed by the chair of the OSRD's Committee on Medical Research, Alfred N. Richards. In his initial meetings with pharmaceutical companies, Richards convinced skeptical executives that the project had a high chance of success and would repay their investments. The deals were sealed with promises of large cost-plus contracts and government-funded technology transfer overseen by the Army. The OSRD and the War Production Board organized the supply chains and cleared any bottlenecks to facilitate a rapid, smooth production ramp-up. The biggest contracts went to Squibb, Merck, and Pfizer. On D-Day in June 1944, nearly 20 firms were producing fermented penicillin. A year later, they were manufacturing a combined 600 billion doses of penicillin every month. The Army could finally reduce its budget for propaganda posters warning against booby traps that spread gonorrhea and syphilis. At every stage, the U.S. government licensed out the technology involved on a royalty-free basis to all qualified applicants to accelerate and maximize production. The buck stopped with Bush, the OSRD director, who considered the program uniquely important, on par with the Manhattan Project, and blocked contractors from seeking controlling rights to the products or processes involved. This suited the scientists, managers, and officials at the Department of Agriculture, who organized the program's key laboratories. Agriculture retained historical and geographical connections to Midwestern populism that made it culturally hostile to patent monopolies in a way that was unique among federal agencies. Under Harding and Coolidge, the department was helmed by Henry C. Wallace, a spiritual and political descendant of the Grange and the Populists. So too was Wallace's son, the New Dealer Henry A. Wallace, who ran the department for 7 years preceding his election as vice president in 1940. For Democrats opposed to Bush's general OSRD policy of allowing contractors to claim title on wartime inventions, penicillin stood as a powerful counterexample. Public universities and research centers had been given a job and performed a medical breakthrough in record time. The government had partnered with industry contractors, both large and small, in mutually beneficial arrangements. For new dealers, it was a demonstration test of self-respecting, competition-minded government patent policy in action. Here was public science serving the public good. Socialism, the penicillin program, was not. Government contractors benefited in two ways. Along with the steady profits earned by fulfilling cost-plus contracts for a guaranteed market, they were recipients of a transformational technology transfer operation that propelled the U.S. pharmaceutical industry into one of the country's most successful sectors, according to the medical historian Roswell Quinn. Many contractors understood the getting was good and milked the opportunity for all it was worth. Cost overruns were often suspiciously large. Some penicillin plants were billed to the government at three times the initial estimate, and the slow pace of construction by firms with the most resources was a common complaint of government progress reports. Investigators with the War Production Board noted early on that contractors were installing subsidized equipment at a peacetime pace, with an eye for appearances, resulting in private facilities in every detail equal to any industrial building built before Pearl Harbor. Attention to luxurious design details, wrote one WPB official, makes one wonder whether they have heard a war is being fought. Of greater concern were suspicions that the largest contractors, including Pfizer, Squibb, and Merck, were intentionally failing their contractual obligations to place all of their research and know-how in a common technology and knowledge pool that had been established to ensure collaboration and transparency. As far as we are concerned here at Peoria, it has been largely a case of giving all our information and receiving very little, R.D. Coghill, a scientific director with the Department of Agriculture, wrote in a 1942 letter to the OSRD in Washington. Coghill's letter was addressed to Alfred Richards, director of the OSRD's medical committee, who was himself rumored to be intentionally shelving such reports and running cover for the companies, above all Merck, which employed him as a consultant prior to the war. All this was overshadowed by the magnitude of the program's success. Among those who believe the success held lessons beyond the war was Vannevar Bush, who wrote in a 1958 letter to Alfred, "One can draw numerous lessons from the penicillin experience, which apply to relations between industrial units and between these and government in time of peace." Gefauver pressed Bush on whether the lessons of the penicillin program weren't obvious, and if they were, why he felt they no longer applied. How did he square his wartime management of penicillin with his current position, crediting patents as the source of all innovation and progress? Was not the requirement of pooling and cross-licensing, the senator said, an important factor in distributing penicillin? "We were fighting a war, Mr. Chairman," replied Bush. "When you are fighting a war, you do a lot of things that you don't do in peacetime. We had a collaboration that was extraordinary. It showed that pharmaceutical companies could put their personal and private affairs aside in the public interest. They collaborated in the best way possible. Under those circumstances, we did what was fair and reasonable. That does not in any way apply to the situation in peacetime." Bush's admission that drug companies' private affairs might be at odds with the public interest was candid. But from a man of Bush's intellect, the larger argument was jumbled. The penicillin project did not succeed due to a temporary suspension of private sector greed, but because academic and government scientists in Oxford and Peoria did their jobs, and their governments fulfilled their constitutional mandates to diffuse science for the public good. The result was a competitive peacetime market for an essential medicine. When the U.S. government reverted afterward to subsidizing research, granting monopolies, and stepping away, the antibiotics market was quickly cartelized by the same companies. Given the easily comparable results, Gefauver believes something closer to the wartime model should be the rule, not the exception. Penicillin wasn't the only recent public science success story involving a breakthrough antibiotic. In 1948, an organic chemist named Selman Waksman discovered a powerful soil-based antibiotic, streptomycin, in a publicly funded lab at Rutgers University. Waksman was baffled that U.S. law would allow the monopolization of a microbial byproduct of common soil. The Rutgers administration agreed and proceeded to patent streptomycin as a novel composition of matter to prevent it from ever becoming a private monopoly. The university licensed the medicine to all comers, domestic and foreign, for a nominal royalty. The effects were similar to those of the penicillin program: competition and downward pressure on prices. The two antibiotics had something else in common. The drug companies hated them and everything they stood for. John McKean, a painter in Pfizer's Brooklyn factory, who rose to become company CEO, growled to a reporter in 1954, "If you want to lose your shirt in a hurry, start making penicillin and streptomycin." Nobody was going bankrupt selling broad-application antibiotics, but McKean's fellow targets in that decade's FTC price-fixing probe, American Cyanamid, Olin, Upjohn, and Bristol-Myers, surely caught his drift. Compared to patented wonder drugs like tetracycline, oromycin, and terramycin, the profits on penicillin were negligible, so small the bigger companies shifted most of their output into animal feed. There was, however, one last remaining avenue for making something like monopoly profits off generic penicillin, cornering the medicine markets in countries too poor to make their own. In 1946, India was on the verge of achieving independence from Britain. But within the Indian National Congress, celebrations were tempered by an awareness of the monumental task of nation-building that lay ahead. The country's public health needs were particularly urgent. Nearly 400 million Indians lived in extreme poverty, and two centuries of export-oriented colonial rule had left the country with little health or industrial infrastructure. The poor country was starting from scratch. A year before the official declaration of independence, Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru sent a team of scientists on a tour of European and North American pharmaceutical plants. They returned with a plan for the domestic manufacturing of essential drugs and medicines, beginning with antibiotics, anti-malarials, and sulfa drugs. One of these was given special priority following the post-independence war with Pakistan. In 1949, Nehru announced the Penicillin Project. At the time, drug patents had no legal standing outside the borders of the nation that issued them. In just about every case, this meant they had no legal standing outside the borders of the United States. But U.S. drug companies enjoyed a structural advantage that could play a role similar to patents. The newly independent nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America had no native capacity to make medicines. Foreign firms exploited this dependence by targeting domestic elites with prices that were often higher than those in the company's home country. The most direct way to end this dependency was by building up domestic manufacturing capacity, a process that required north-to-south technology transfer. The problem was the same then as it is in the age of COVID-19. The most technologically advanced drug companies had no interest in helping developing nations achieve self-sufficiency. When tech transfer did take place, the foreign firms dictated the terms, usually maintaining strict control over local production and pricing, thus undermining sovereignty and development. This was the dilemma facing Nehru as he issued the tender for India's first penicillin plant in 1949. Nehru began by aiming high. His goal was a state-owned manufacturing plant under the control of Indian scientists and technicians. The bids that he received in return offered humiliating variations on the proposal. Companies were eager to provide penicillin, but not transfer the latest fermentation technology or train Indian scientists in the know-how needed to run the factories. In the bid submitted by Pfizer and Glaxo, Nehru's proposed factory was reduced to a refining and bottling center for bulk penicillin shipped directly from the company's U.S. factories. The best of the bad offers belonged to Merck. The company offered to build a full-cycle penicillin factory in India, conditional on the payment of burdensome royalties extending for decades. The company attempted to sweeten the pitch by dangling access to a certain proprietary trade secret that only its technicians possessed. Providing a partial description of this secret, Merck officials claimed that it would reduce local prices in the long term and thus take the sting out of the long-term royalties clause. Indian scientists determined that the secret manufacturing method in question was not Merck's, but the subject of a recent article in Industrial Engineering Chemistry, a journal available at Indian libraries. The inventors of the process were two University of Wisconsin scientists who had worked on the Department of Agriculture's wartime penicillin project. After the war, one of them took a research job at Merck. The other went to work for the newly established health agency of the young United Nations. As it happened in the fall of 1950, this very agency, the World Health Organization, was in the process of devising a plan to blow up Merck's India deal, which Nehru was leaning toward accepting in the mistaken belief that nothing better was on the way. After its founding in October 1945, the United Nations began developing a program to assist the decolonizing countries of what became known as the Global South. The agencies at the center of this program were the Children's Fund, UNICEF, established in 1948, and the World Health Organization, WHO, established in 1949. Bringing the new wonder drugs of the West to the rest of the world was a primary concern, One of the WHO's first actions was to set up an expert panel on antibiotics. Officials within UNICEF and the WHO had been monitoring the situation in India closely since Nehru announced the penicillin project. When it appeared the country was fated to accept the Merck offer a year later, they decided to intervene. A delegation was dispatched to New Delhi with a proposal for the Indian government. The UN would provide $1.2 million in grants to pay for the construction of a large-scale penicillin plant, as well as the technical support, know-how, and trainings necessary to operate the plant after the UN technicians departed. What the UN asked in return was a negative print of the Merck offer. All that the UN required of India in return was an open-door scientific policy and a commitment to supply penicillin at no cost to Indian children through publicly funded health programs, writes the economic historian Nasir Tyagi. The offer also stipulated that India agree not to establish links between the plant and commercial firms that might wish to keep manufacturing methods secret and furthermore would agree to operate the plant as part of a network of international antibiotics research and training centers that UNICEF and WHO were in the process of establishing. In every detail, the UN proposal aligned perfectly with Nehru's internationalist views on South-South solidarity and broader Gandhian notions of self-reliance and internal development. Still, some of Nehru's advisors urged caution and worried that the UN did not possess enough technological expertise to guarantee success. Merck played on these anxieties by making new promises about access to its trade secrets. The UN countered by deploying scientific luminaries who supported the project to build non-profit drug sectors and research hubs across the global south. Those sent to India to vouch for the UN's competence included Howard Florey and Ernest Chain, the Nobel Prize-winning developers of penicillin. But perhaps the most decisive role belonged to the British biochemist Edward Mellenby, a man whose disdain for the American embrace of monopoly medicine was both deep and deeply personal. In 1919, Mellenby gained fame for isolating vitamin D and identifying its deficiency as the cause of rickets. Like Britain's scientific and medical establishments, he was dumbstruck and made livid by Steinbach's Sunshine Patent and the merging of academic research and monopoly represented by the WARF. As the Secretary of Britain's Medical Research Council during World War II, he maintained a strict no-patent policy. When Ernst Chain urged Mellenby to patent some of the methods for producing penicillin cultures, if only as a defensive measure, he refused. He would not follow the Americans into the gutter of post-ethical science and medicine. After the war, U.S. firms would win process patents based on research conducted by Chain and Florey at Oxford, further curdling his loathing of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. The bitterness this engendered still lingers. In a graduation speech to the class of 2020, Oxford University Vice Chancellor Louise Richardson defended patenting the university's COVID-19 research for the public good so as to avoid repeating the mistake of the early 40s when Oxford academics discovered penicillin but handed all rights off to American companies. In the summer of 1951, Mellenby met with Nehru and finalized India's acceptance of the UN offer. The Englishman could only have relished the chance to check the spread of monopoly system he loathed. But the satisfaction he felt was deeper than the sort accompanying an isolated tactical victory. Mellenby knew the significance of the UN project went beyond a single penicillin factory, free from any private interest. The construction of Hindustan Antibiotics in the city of Pune was intended to provide the cornerstone for a public drug sector designed as part of a global counter-system to the one symbolized by Merck. For the next 2 years, Mellenby remained in India to help build the system as the founding director of the Central Drug Research Institute in Lucknow, India's first national research laboratory. Portent of India's first step to pharmaceutical self-sufficiency did not escape drug companies with global ambitions. An Indian firm capable of fermenting penicillin today would be able to reverse engineer other medicines tomorrow and manufacture them at scale for export across the global south. Merck's defeat left the industry alarmed about its future beyond U.S. borders. The company had been isolated and blocked out of a major market without a friend in the world. Even Truman's State Department supported the UN project. The idea of an international legal regime protecting U.S. drug patents abroad, meanwhile, was closer to the era's science fiction than an imaginable reality. This feeling of being alone and against the ropes only intensified mid-decade with the launch of the 1955 FTC probe, followed by the emergence of the first celebrity scientist of the television age, an American Mellenby whose achievement rivaled penicillin, named Jonas Salk. For 60 years, poliomyelitis was a fearsome and democratic stalker of American children. Diphtheria thrived in crowded tenements. Poliovirus could strike anywhere, from the slums to the country estates of the rich. It rolled through the country in regular but unpredictable waves, each time sending thousands of children, aged 5 and younger, through a terrifying progressive illness that caused asphyxiation, paralysis, and death. The vaccine that ended polio in the United States was developed with public funds in the most literal sense. Unlike the government, which funds science through Treasury-issued debt, the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis, NFIP, built a direct pipeline between the wallets of ordinary Americans and the laboratories conducting the research. It was constructed from thousands of cardboard boxes and glass jars full of spare coins and dirty dollar bills. The campaign began in January 1934, when the NFIP raised $1 million through 6,000 community-organized birthday balls thrown to honor the nation's most famous polio victim, Franklin Roosevelt. The next polio drive benefited from celebrity spokesmen Bud Abbott, Lou Costello, and Eddie Cantor, who in 1938 suggested the idea of a permanent loose change campaign called the March of Dimes. The CEO of theater chain Lowe's, Inc., Nicholas Schenck, threw his support behind the campaign, in part to burnish his company's image as a good corporate citizen. Schenck was in the midst of a federal antitrust suit to block his acquisition of what became Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. Boxes with coin slots, marked with the NFIP logo, popped up in every conceivable public space, movie theaters especially, bringing in enough money to underwrite polio research in leading institutions. In 1947, the March of Dimes funded the multi-million-dollar construction and staffing of a two-floor laboratory at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. It was in this lab that Jonas Salk developed his novel Dead Virus Polio Vaccine. Only hours after the vaccine was announced a success, on April 12, 1955, Edward R. Murrow interviewed Salk on See It Now, the country's highest-rated primetime news show. Toward the end of the segment, Murrow turned to a subject Americans were beginning to hear and think more about, medicine patents. Leaning forward, the legendary newsman fixed a piercing stare on Salk and put the question, "Who owns the patent on this vaccine?" Salk paused briefly before stammering, "The people, I would say. There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" Salk was not the first person to invoke the sun as a symbol for the scientific commons. His comment echoed the ancients who believed knowledge was as indivisible as the natural elements, as common as air. The Republican founders, every invention or improvement of science as universal as the influence of the sun, and the medical gatekeepers of the mid and late 19th century. It would seem to me like patent sunlight. 20 years earlier, Morris Fishbein had criticized the vitamin D monopoly by saying the sun in the sky should be freely available to all who wish to use it. It's possible that Salk had Fishbein's words in mind when he answered Morrow's question. If knowledge is meant to be shared, so are metaphors and quips. Wherever Salk drew his inspiration, the reaction to this expression of the classical view of knowledge suggests the public was already souring on the country's still young post-ethical pharmaceutical industry. The humble hero of open science and antipode to drug industry greed was never quite as pure as the myth. As a young researcher investigating influenza at the University of Michigan in the early 1940s, Salk was the subject of laboratory gossip over rumors he was entertaining a consulting deal with Parke Davis. His boss at the time, acclaimed virologist Thomas Francis, stepped in and squelched the deal. It was becoming common for scientists in public labs to accept consulting side gigs, but Francis maintained the old ways. The arrangement would have obligated Salk to provide the company with data and patents on his inventions in return for royalties flowing from their successful commercialization. Salk had been conflicted over the offer, but with a growing family to support, he allowed himself to rationalize the temptation. After moving to Pittsburgh to begin full-time work on polio, Salk accepted another offer from Parke Davis to consult on the development of adjuvants, a component of vaccines that boosts potency. When Salk started to achieve fame in the early 1950s, the company threatened the relationship by using Salk's name in promotional materials that falsely implied that Parke Davis was involved in his polio research. There's no evidence that Salk anguished much over his moonlighting for the private sector, but it did inform his lifetime skepticism about the industry's reliability and trustworthiness. This surfaced in 1953 during the NFIP's search for companies to produce vaccine for the following year's nationwide field trial. More than anyone else in the organization, Salk anticipated problems with money-minded contractors. He strongly advised against giving one company control over production, and instead advocated for a pooling approach that enlisted all those who are interested in helping solve the problem of poliomyelitis. Salk comprehended that drug manufacturers were entrepreneurs, not academic scientists. They occasionally ignored the minimum requirements and made cost-saving decisions, writes his biographer, Charlotte DeCrosse Jacobs. Salk's vaccine formula was complex, expensive, and required following his protocol with precision. Each of the protocol's hundreds of steps, he knew, presented opportunities and temptations to cut corners. Along with opening up the process to multiple companies, Salk insisted that companies not be entrusted with testing the finished batches. Salk's boss at NFIP, Basil O'Connor, at first resisted the idea of adding a fail-safe testing layer, but eventually consented to random screening by the National Institutes of Health's Laboratory of Biologics Control. Events justified Salk's concerns. The NFIP contracted six companies to produce the industrial-scale batches of vaccine required for the field trial. Pittman Moore, Sharp and Dohme, Wyeth Laboratories, Eli Lilly, Cutter Laboratories, and Park Davis. Each firm was paid 300% over production costs. Their request that NFIP pay for upgrades to the facilities was rejected. Without the customary protection of secret formulas and patented procedures, the manufacturers had to rely on speed and efficiency to give them a profitable share of the potential market, notes Jacobs. This fed Salk's primary fear. His unease mounted early in the production process when he sensed many of the corporate lab chiefs were planning to tweak or fudge items in his detailed instructions. The biggest red flag on Salk's radar involved Park Davis. As Jane S. Smith writes in her history of the polio vaccine, Salk suspected a subtle form of sabotage. He thought Park Davis was trying to discredit his inactivation process so the company could switch to a method of virus inactivation with ultraviolet radiation on which it held a patent. Whatever the motivations, his fears came true when a number of batches rolled out by the companies were found to contain live poliovirus. In April 1955, several states reported cases of children contracting polio immediately after receiving the shot. Salk knew there was nothing wrong with his vaccine. There had never been issues with batches produced by his lab, nor had there been any such reports out of the field trials underway in Canada and Denmark. He suspected correctly that the contractors were not following instructions for reasons of greed or incompetence. During a pause in the trial, investigators traced more than 100 polio cases, including five deaths, back to the California factory of Cutter Laboratories. In the 1970s and 80s, as a subsidiary of Bayer, the company would be tied to numerous blood products tainted with HIV. A technical audit showed the company had cut corners and failed to follow protocols. After its government contract was terminated, the company faced ruin, its name forever synonymous with the scandal known as the Cutter Incident. An NIH audit followed multiple other botched lots back to the factories of Park Davis and Eli Lilly. Unlike Cutter, the drug giants were cleared of intentional wrongdoing and given valuable second chances. Eli Lilly, the main contractor, made $30 million in profit during its first year producing polio vaccine for the U.S. government. The cost to the government was the subject of a second scandal around Salk's polio vaccine. On three occasions in the late 1950s, five companies, including Merck, quoted the same price to federal, state, and local agencies. The FTC charged them with price-fixing and criminal conspiracy involving $54 million in government purchase orders. A federal judge later dismissed the case on appeal, citing a lack of evidence. When the field test resumed in May, Salk faced no resistance when he insisted every batch undergo mandatory screenings by the National Institutes of Health. The Cutter incident was 7 years old, but not quite forgotten when Kefauver introduced his reform bill to the Senate in July 1962. Despite his committee's investigative work over nearly 3 years of hearings, and despite all the scandals and systemic corruption it dredged up, the bill was delivered dead on arrival. Heading into an election year, Democrats felt stretched on other issues. Few were in the mood to antagonize financially powerful drug companies over patents, even if, as many told Kefauver in private, they agreed with him on the substance. House and Senate versions of the bill were all but lying in state when, as happened in 1906, a drug safety scandal changed the course of events. In late July, the Washington Post published a front-page report detailing links between a tranquilizer called thalidomide and thousands of stunted limb birth defects throughout Europe, where pregnant women were given the drug to treat anxiety. The U.S. licensee had planned to introduce the drug into the American market in the winter of 1960, the Post explained, but had been held up by the brave and determined stubbornness of a newly hired FDA medical staffer named Francis Kelsey. Citing large holes in the company's toxicity data, Kelsey refused to greenlight the drug. For 2 years, she stood her ground in the face of industry and internal agency pressure to approve the sedative as a harmless anxiety treatment for women. Post report made Kelsey a national hero, hailed as a model public servant and awarded a medal for distinguished federal civilian service. The scandal shocked life back into Kefauver's bill. Its proposals to expand FDA regulation of drug testing and safety now seem prescient, common sense, and overdue. No such reconsideration, however, attended the patent reforms at the core of the legislation as drafted by Kefauver. On the morning of October 10th, 4 days before a U.S. spy plane identified Soviet missiles in Cuba, Kennedy signed a revised version of Kefauver's bill. It was gutted of every reform that touched the post-ethical industry's business model, and which had been based on years of investigation and testimony. The 1962 amendments to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act contained no mention of patents, prices, competition, or marketing. Its narrow focus was limited to strengthening the FDA's capacity and purview to test, monitor, and regulate drugs. In remarks that accompanied his signing of the bill, Kennedy seemed to acknowledge the tortured history and whittled ambition of the law remembered as the Kefauver-Harris Amendments, named for its original drafter and its House sponsor, Arkansas Democrat Orrin Harris. "We want to pay particular appreciation to Senator Kefauver for the long hearings which he held," said the president. "These hearings permitted us to have very effective legislation on hand when this matter became of such strong public interest." With the receding of the thalidomide scandal, Kennedy assumed that the patent issue of such concern to Kefauver and Kilgore before him was no longer of strong public interest. This was not a point that Kefauver was willing to concede in what turned out to be the last year of his life. After his party erased his bill of every mention of patents, he started work on a book aimed at a popular audience based on his drug industry investigation. In his Senate subcommittee, he carried the fight for public control of public science and its spoils into new terrain. His final sentence in the Senate record was a statement delivered from the floor during an August 1963 debate over amendments to the Communications Satellite Act of 1962, which created the nation's first commercial satellite company. In the middle of his statement, Kefauver paused and excused himself, saying he did not feel well. After taking a short break, he recovered sufficiently to denounce the corporation as a private monopoly, writes the historian Daniel Scroop in his account of the senator's death from a ruptured aortic aneurysm. Within 48 hours, Kefauver, the most prominent and persistent critic of monopoly in the immediate post-war era, and the man for whom business lobbyists coined the phrase, "In Kefauver we antitrust," was dead. Surviving him was a defiantly reprobate drug industry, determined to avoid further challenges to its power, wealth, and monopoly birthright.